This is a particularly exciting moment for me because I did work at the United Nations Development Program for 7 years, and Halley Malik, whom I'm about to introduce, was a leader in that organization. I was brand new to the whole UN system. He had a way of working his way through problems that I didn't even know how to begin to solve. And as a result, my time there was very smooth. I want to mention that Sarah Papineau is in the audience, and she was my assistant there. So I'm delighted to have both of them with me here. Halley Malik is now the director of the Human Development Report Office and has been doing that for the last 4 years, since June of 2011. He also served as the UN representative in China and the director and chair of the UNDP Evaluation Office and our UN representative in Uzbekistan. So he's had a lot of experience in a large part of the world, in a variety of spots in the world, and it's really exciting to have him here. The Human Development Report, which is not exactly a household word, but it's well known among the research people, education area, and colleges have them in their libraries. The Human Development Report started, how many years ago, Ali? 1990, and it is an intellectually independent, empirically driven report that comes out every year, and it basically is focusing on health, education, gender equity, expansive human expansion of human freedoms and abilities, and which countries have the most choices in all of those areas. there's a human development index in each report that actually lists countries according to their position in each of those various areas and many more. The Human Development Index has become a standard that countries look at to say, well, why aren't, you know, we in the Netherlands are as good as Norway in longevity or whatever the measurement is, and they get competitive. So it's worked very well, and that's why for all those years, it keeps coming out and is watched very closely by the various leaders in most of the developing world and to a good bit in the developed world. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce a very fine man who's born in Pakistan, went to Oxford, honors that he's received over the years will go unmentioned, but he has plenty, just take my word for it. And Mr. Halley Malik is going to take over the program and tell us a little bit more about the Human Development Report.
Thank you, Bill, and it's really a great pleasure to be here, and thanks to the World Affairs Council and the Global Philanthropy Forum. And it's particularly a great pleasure because I'm here with Bill Draper. Bill was my former boss, and I think he really introduced great reforms and far-sighted changes in UNDP. One big change was to identify young people who would go the distance, as it were. And I think he was very modest when he said that always say good things about other people, but he's actually responsible for the Human Development Report. It was Mahbub ul Haq, just by chance another Pakistani, convinced Bill that this may be a good enterprise, and they thought 1 year's report was going to be it. But I think this report would not have existed without Bill's leadership and support and protecting it. There were times when it creates so much disturbance in New York that it needed a huge amount of heavy lifting to protect and save it. And I think we, all of us, owe a debt of gratitude to Bill for his great leadership. And so what a privilege to be in San Francisco and to have him moderate this thing. I'm going today to do a couple of things. One is simply talk for 10 minutes. And there's a little slideshow in the back. I know there's a recording and a radio broadcast of this conversation. But the purpose of this 10-minute introduction is to do that, to introduce you to the report. And I'm also very pleased that my wife is here, and Sarah Papino, who just by happenstance was with me in London, when was it, 10 days ago? So listening to the same thing, so some people may have heard it a few more times. Anyhow, so it's a great privilege to be here in San Francisco. To join in some ways, the West Coast launch of the 2014 Human Development Report on Vulnerability and Resilience. I talked about Mahbub ul-Haq because he's a Pakistani, but he also was instrumental in launching this report. And his friendship and partnership with Amartya Sen, who later on got a Nobel laureate, has really been the foundation for this report. And it's been a privilege for me to carry that mantle, for a few years. The core message of this report is that real progress on human development is not only a matter of enlarging people's choices. That's a core idea of human development, to lead a healthy, long life, to be educated, and to enjoy a decent standard of living. It is also about ensuring that these choices are secure and sustainable. And that requires us to understand very fundamentally and tackle vulnerability. This is the first time we actually looked at vulnerability in a human development report. And this is particularly important for the global debate around the post-2015 development agendas. I hope some of you are intimately involved in it. There's a lot of debate as to what should be the next step beyond 2015 when the global goals complete and the next set of goals are being debated. The view is that progress will not be sustainable unless vulnerability is addressed. There's, for instance, growing consensus about getting to zero poverty. The current goal was to reduce poverty by half. And there's a view that it's possible to eliminate poverty in the next 15, 20 years. But we say this is not enough. Not only do you have to get to zero poverty, but you have to stay at zero so that people do not fall back into poverty when shocks occur. The 2014 report shows that human development progress is slowing down and is increasingly precarious for many. And you can see that in the report, and those who have a chance to look at it, progress is slowing down. Last year's report was about a very positive sounding report, the expansion of choices, not billions of people doing better over the last decade. So it was a kind of a very positive way of looking at the world. This one still is positive, but tends to dig deeper on what is not working. Globalization, for instance, we all know has brought a lot of benefits, but it's also created new risks. It's possible for one bank failure in New York to affect the whole world, and that's what happened in the 2007-2008 Great Recession, which still has not fully, we haven't fully recovered as a globe from that. And this year has seen the highest ever number of people displaced by violence, some 45 million people. So this shows that in an increasingly connected world, we face new vulnerabilities. Traditionally, most analysis of vulnerability is in relation to specific risks, disasters, conflicts. But in this report, we try to dig a little deeper, take a wider approach to understand the underlying drivers of vulnerability, and try to understand and make recommendations on how individual society can become more resilient and recover better and quicker from setbacks. And the report focuses on those who are particularly disadvantaged, particularly vulnerable, such as the poor, and asks why some people or communities are more resilient than others, even when they face the same risks. And it develops two basic propositions. One is that people's vulnerability is influenced by their levels of capabilities. If you are richer, better educated, have a higher income, you can somehow deal with adversity better. But and your social position, if you are marginalized as groups, even if you're better educated, but you form part of a minority, you feel vulnerable in some ways. If you are gender discriminated, there's a deficit there. The other proposition is failures to protect people in this vulnerability are often the consequence of inadequate policies and poor social institutions. Means that you can do something about it, and I'll come back to that. It's a critical concern for many people, vulnerability. We brought on some new numbers. 1.5 billion people still live in multidimensional poverty. So we go beyond income poverty, look at health and education deprivations. Nearly 80% of the world lacks social protection. About 12%, or 842 million people, suffer from chronic hunger, and nearly half of all workers, more than 1.5 billion people, are in formal or precarious employment. And one has to look even deeper at some of these figures. Take the case of poverty. We talked about 1.5 billion being multidimensional poor, but half as many again, something like another 800 million people are just above the poverty line. So a shock can easily push them back into poverty. And more than 1.5 billion people live in countries affected by conflicts. The report talks about many things, but tries to build up two underlying principles. First is universalism. There's a strong view, and it's actually from the 18th century, Immanuel Kant's perspective, that all human beings have equal worth. So by that logic, everyone has a right to education, healthcare, and other basic services. So universalism is about pursuing equal life chances for all, and equal consideration for all demands unequal treatment in favor of the disadvantaged. You cannot level the playing field by just giving equal treatment. The second principle is actually, we refer to it as putting people first. All policies, especially macroeconomic ones, must be seen as a means to an end, not an end in themselves. And policymakers must ask some basic questions. Who's benefiting from economic growth? Are people feeling more vulnerable? Are people being left behind? And it's not an idle thought. You look at growth rates, and take the United Kingdom, for instance. If you adjust growth rates and compare the 1980s with 1990s, the 1990s were not considered to be as good as 1980s. But the minute you adjust by income inequality, the position almost reverses itself. So there's a view that if you look at the bottom 40% of all population in all countries, you'll find a very different perspective on what growth rates actually mean. The report introduces some interesting ideas. One is the concept of structural vulnerabilities. These occur when particular groups suffer disadvantage on multiple fronts. The poor suffer from many risks. Natural disaster, women who suffer pervasive discrimination in most countries, or older people who are likely to be more poor or disabled. It's quite remarkable that when you look at older people, 60 and above, some of us have joined that category. Bill, of course, remains forever young. He looks exactly the way when he was my boss, so that's brilliant. But you'll be amazed that the percentage of the older people who are poor and disabled is remarkably high, over 60%. The second interesting thought which is introduced in the report is about how capabilities, issue of lifelong capabilities or life vulnerabilities, how these are formed over a person's lifetime and the threats that people face at different stages of their life, from infancy through youth, adulthood, and age. And it tries to highlight the sensitive phases which need particular support. Take the case of, there's a lot of interesting new work done, including by James Heckman, the Nobel laureate, but others as well. We took at evidence from two countries, different countries, USA and Ecuador. And what is amazing is that children's early exposure to language starts even before they go to school. And success, their success is profoundly connected to the quality of the home environment. Gaps in the vocabularies of children from rich and poorer countries open up even at age 3 and widen thereafter. Now, this is quite remarkable. There's another figure we've used that the difference is actually 2 million more words heard by children, this is before they go to school or preschool, pre-K, in more professional families compared to poorer families. The transition from school to the labor force, another sensitive transition. You have, in many developing countries, the proportion of young people increased has tremendously increased in the last 40 years, creating what is known as a youth bulge. But the growing numbers of youth are not yet matched by increase in jobs. So we did some interesting projections. By 2050, under a business-as-usual scenario, the gap will continue to grow in most regions. But ambitious policies, and they are fast-track education and accelerated inclusive economic growth, can close the gap for South Asia and reduce it substantially for Sub-Saharan Africa. When the Arab Spring happened, we tried to understand why did it take place mostly in countries which are doing quite well on human development. And the when we dug into it, the answer was also quite straightforward, that when people get more educated, the relationship between the citizen state changes. They expect more from the state. They expect to have jobs, to be treated with dignity. And where the gap was the widest in terms of job opportunities, those were the countries where Arab Spring took place. Of course, these are complex matters. Of course, the one half of the report talks about vulnerability. The other half is what to do about it and how to build resilience. And we actually have taken a rather strong position, I hope you have questions on that, on a bunch of things. First, universal access to basic social services, education, healthcare, water and sanitation enhance resilience. When benefits, you know, many economists, particularly when they're taught in certain universities, they will argue that benefits need to be narrowly targeted because somehow it's more efficient that way. But actually, when that happens, it's not that efficient either, because the middle class is often less willing to fund these benefits when they're not part of that, when they're not receiving some benefits through taxes. Targeting also has high tax transaction costs, and a broader, more inclusive approach works better and can be more effective. And then we'll go into some detail in the report to show both in developed countries and developing countries is the case. But you know, economists also have argued that you have to be somehow rich to finance universalism. Actually, history shows us otherwise. In countries as diverse as Costa Rica, Scandinavian countries, Republic of Korea, and others, the first step towards universal provision of basic social service was taken at relatively low levels of income per capita, lower than South Asia today. And this is profoundly important because when those countries took those decisions, there was a basic commitment by the state to its citizens. And of course, we know that universal coverage can take time. But the gains to expanded coverage start to accrue long before coverage is universal. The report also reminds us that social spending should occur when it's most needed. I talked about the first years of a child's life being so profound and so important. But most countries don't do this, actually. Most countries spend very little money in the beginning, a little bit more money later on, and much more money when you get older. Sweden is a good outlier here. Children's development and brain growth are extremely rapid during the earliest years, and that's exactly when budget allocations are the most thin. So it makes sense. It's not just the level of budgets, but the timing of it, which is so important, and has a huge impact on things, problems you can prevent for the future. When children get, because of nutrition deprivation and this, when children get stunted, it's very difficult to unstunt children along. You affect their entire lives. Third, the report also makes a strong call for the return of full employment as a central policy goal as it was in the 50s and 60s. And we argue it's now time to return to the commitment. Wages, jobs are far more important than the wages you get from it. It brings social benefits, social stability, social cohesion, and decent jobs strengthen people's ability to manage risks and uncertainty. And again, a lot of analysis goes in the report on numbers and budgets to look at that. Fourth, protecting choices is a critical part of building resilience. In 2009, the UN heads of agencies, particularly ILO and others, introduced a social protection flows initiative, arguing that it is possible to introduce a bunch of these services in most countries in the world and to convey that thing is affordable. And we are hoping that this could be one of the goals of the next set of sustainable development goals. At the same time, it's recognized that all this may not be enough. If social norms and laws do not protect the rights of groups that face discrimination. In the end, when you really dig into issues as to why is there conflict, you realize it's the result of long-standing discrimination and uneven access to social service, which over time builds up into profound resentments, and at times groups try to recover their ground. So in order to respond to this, you need responsible, responsive and accountable institutions. Better norms, equity, equality in gender, all those things, and stronger collective action can help ensure the states and markets recognize and reflect the interests and rights of vulnerable people, especially the poor and minorities. But national action can only go far. International action is also essential. And the last part of the report, and I'll finish in a few minutes, talks about global action. It identifies two large challenges. One is an under-provisioning of global public goods, ranging from disease control to global market regulation. In some ways, we have a situation of 20th century institutions trying to deal with 21st century realities. This under-provision permits shocks to have global reach. So managing and controlling food price volatility, global recession, climate change are all essential public goods and markets so far ill-equipped to provide. Let me give you some very specific examples. Syria, for instance. We all know the tragedy which is unfolding in Syria now. But one of the drivers of that vulnerability was actually of a drought which took place in 2002 for about 4 or 5 years, severe drought, which led about over 2 million farmers, of the 10 million farmers in Syria, being pushed out of agriculture into urban areas where they were without jobs and destitution. And that created this cauldron of despair, which led, of course, contributed to that. The same is true of Niger. Every decade, there's a drought leading to a food crisis. And you have a challenge of what I would say repeated humanitarian development interventions, which try to deal with the situation, but when the underlying deficit is not addressed, which is lack of climate change agreements, because these things will keep coming back. So we have to find a better way of dealing with these global market failures and to think of regional and global shock absorbers, such as regional financial institutions. People may remember that in the 90s, there was a big Asian crisis, and there was a proposal to create an Asian Monetary Fund, which didn't go very far. In the report, we said time has come to look at some of these things. So many national measures are also easier when global commitments are in place. That's why the post-2015 agenda must include universal public services, social protection flows, and full employment as key goals. So in conclusion, we feel strongly there's now an imperative to move towards resilient, sustainable human development. And the report tries to make a case this is feasible and necessary. And it's clear that markets alone will not provide adequate social and environment protections. We have to find a better balance between private and public interests. In our view, of course, we know progress takes work and leadership. Many of the Millennium Development Goals are likely to be met by 2015. It's a huge achievement of the world. But future success is automatic, and the gains are not necessarily permanent. Helping vulnerable groups and reducing inequality are essential to sustaining development both now and future generations. Thank you very much.
So, Khalid, you mentioned full employment as a goal. Do you go into any description in the in your recommendations as to how you get to that full employment? Because it's easy to say set various goals, but if you don't give some guide to how do you get there, and what are you? This is a bit of a trap because I'm very interested in your answer. If you say government, watch out.
Yeah. You know, the great thing about having Bill as a boss was that we were constantly on our toes to say that it should be everyone, but I'll come to that. You know, in the 1560s, when this was a strategic goal of many industrialized countries, you look at unemployment levels, they were 2-3% in most developed countries. But when that objective got lost and shifted ground, and I think a lot is to do with the certain economists who promoted a certain way of looking at the world, that somehow if you let markets function without a certain amount of support, encouragement, and regulation, that you'll get the right outcomes. I think markets work best when you have strong state institutions. One without the other does not work so well. And you need both to function and produce it. Huh? And therefore, this idea that markets alone will produce the answer doesn't work. The second part is, if you look at all the data and also in the report, you'll find that capital mobility, which became very free in the 90s onwards, somehow changed the dynamics a lot. And I'll give you a very specific example. The rate of return in financial markets is much higher than rate of return in real goods markets, meaning production of manufacturers and services. So what happens is that people tend to invest in things which do not produce much employment. So I think one has to recalibrate the world in many ways. And part of the challenge also is, 76 years ago, I think Keynes was right then and right now, that when the economy is declining, reducing in recession, that's not the time to start cutting budgets even more. You start cutting budgets when you're in an age of prosperity. And I think many of the policies which have been undertaken, certainly in Europe, have not been very conducive to quickly recovering from recessions and pushing towards full employment. So I think there are no easy answers to it, but once you have a strategic objective, then you try to find the answer how best to get to that particular point.
Good. I wouldn't mind a few more sentences about the private sector being fairly important in building up job creation. There was something in your comments, or it was some of the publicity that you got through the newspapers, the USA Today or so, that said you wanted in the report that equal economies did correct. Better than. Could you explain that a little bit?
You know, when we look at the data,
because all I can think of is communism doesn't work, right? So there's no question about that. Socialism really doesn't work very well.
Yeah. By the way, he appointed me as a UN representative in Uzbekistan, which is coming out of communism at that time. So,
I think that. Congratulations.
Yeah.
I forgot to congratulate you on that.
Yeah. So I think what you have is that when you look at the data, what comes up is very impressive that cohesive societies are those which are more equal societies. And high levels of inequality are bad for the economy and bad for social stability. As you know, Joe Stiglitz also produced a book recently on the price of inequality, where he argued in the US, for instance, that inequality reached such levels that is beginning to affect aggregate demand, meaning that you cannot simply, by using standard rules of fiscal policy and monetary policy, affect demand to keep on growing. You have to do something else, because it doesn't matter how much rich people spend, they will not be able to spend enough to keep the economy going. So I think you have to take a step back. And when you look at the data, what is amazing, what is really quite compelling is that even things like teenage pregnancies, they are much better indicators of social performance when inequality levels are lower. And I think we can talk a lot about it. And actually, it's better for growth rates as well. So growth is sustained for longer periods when you do that as well. And I can, of course, elaborate further on that.
Now, here is a question from the audience. Should we encourage the development of high labor content employment in useful jobs and the decorative arts as well to absorb excessive unemployment? I'm glad you're answering that.
The 2015 report, the next year's report, is going to be on jobs and employment and trying to understand, are we going into a direction, you know, for instance, there's a UK study which says that by 2050, 40% of the new jobs will be automation related. And so you'll end up having what they call two extremes, a high end of very highly productive jobs, globally connected people, high salaries, and a low end of repetitive, difficult jobs, and a hauling out of the middle bit tremendously. For instance, entire professions, I don't know, this may actually please some people, lawyers and accountancies, may disappear because you have algorithms will tell you basically what needs to be done or how to do these things. I think one has to ask a very basic question. What is the economy for? I mean, it's stood for people. The 1990 report, which Bill kind of launched, had a wonderful first sentence which said, people are the real wealth of nations. So if you accept that proposition, you have to then find a way to give people the opportunities to live the lives they value. And one big part of that opportunity is a job, and a decent job at that. So I think we have to take a step back, rethink these things. These are not mandated things. These are all result of human being decisions, all of us leaders' decision in guiding a certain economic system or a certain social system. And yes to decorative arts.
Good. This is a question about what social ingredients should have existed in the time of the Arab Spring and not turn into an Arab winter, was the comment.
Yeah, I mentioned the Arab Spring, and I think when the relationship between citizen state, and I think this is true not just for the Middle East, but also China and India. In China, you have over 600 million people on the web. So if you are a Chinese apparatchik or leader, it's really tough. The job is very difficult now because people are looking at you all the time. And transparency, accountability, people are photographing you. A few years ago, there was a big train accident near Beijing in a town called Tianjin. A train got off the tracks, killed a lot of people. And the first reaction of officials was to start digging a ditch to bury the evidence. But that didn't, you know, of course, burying a train is not so simple. You know, you have to have caterpillars and things to, but, you know, people were filming it, and they filmed it and put it out on the web, and before you knew it, the pressure was so intense, the premier had to come himself a few days later and promise a transparent review of the whole situation. I think these things will only intensify in the future because people are getting better educated. They will demand more and expect more from the state. So states have to start reforming and getting their game pitched at a little higher level.
You served in China, know it very well, and this question comes from the audience. One child policy in China was effectively controlled the population growth in that nation. Do you think other developing or third world nations should adopt similar policies to control rapid unsustainable population growth? And by the way, we both know that China is now suffering somewhat from that problem.
Well, actually, fertility rates are declining almost everywhere, except a few countries in Africa. And so I think we are already moving into that quite rapidly. Even in countries like Bangladesh, growth rates, population growth rates have gone down to 1.4, 1.3%, which is really dramatic. There are a few holdouts, my country included, Pakistan and Kenya and others, but and there's a reason for it, education. Education to transform, particularly of women, transforms the entire context because not only you want to improve your current situation, but you want to improve the conditions for the next generation. And I think this is going to have increasingly large impact. Now, whether you need draconian measures and strong measures like that, we know that there are challenges in China. In fact, there's a phrase which is used in China that we are getting old before we got rich, meaning that it's fast becoming an aging society. East Asia, for instance, is an aging society. Europe is an aging society. US is quite interesting. It's not. So it's one of the few developed countries which is not aging as rapidly as other developed countries.
You referred on that subject, you referred to the youth bulge. I would think that would be a good thing. Why is it considered a problem?
I think the youth bulge can be good if you do certain things with it. It can be a disaster if you don't prepare for it. Africa is a billion people. Sub-Saharan Africa is a billion people now. By 2050, it'll be 2 billion people. Africa, 7 of the 10 fastest growing economies in Africa. But the challenge, unfortunately, is that Africa is not generating enough jobs when compared to East Asia at comparable levels of development. So if these people who are the youth bulge as they enter the labor market and do not have jobs, then you also have huge challenges in front of you of managing the process. Arab Spring is one aspect of that.
What is the relation? Here's a question. I would like to hear a little bit more about too, even though I had some involvement in the Human Development Report. What is the relationship between the Human Development Report and human rights? Now,
well,
you mentioned that you have a right. Everyone has a right to good health, good education, and so on. Is that as far as we go with human rights in the Human Development Report?
The core idea of human development is to expand your choices of living the lives you value. So there's a normative aspect there as well, that you are not only receiving development, but you want to participate and live that life. And rights are very much an essential part of that whole equation because as I talked about in the 2014 report, if you may be well-educated, you may be rich, but if you are a minority in a majority-dominant country, very quickly you realize you're not an equal citizen, that you feel vulnerable as a result of that. Therefore, rights protection is a profoundly important component of overall human development.
Here's a question that's quite germane to Silicon Valley. There's an international grassroots movement to develop tech solutions. We say tech around here, we don't go technology. Tech solutions to address poverty issues. How can these organizations best pursue this endeavor to supplant or complement the findings of this Human Development Report?
You know, I was privileged to attend the last Global Philanthropy Forum. I met some good friends there. And it kind of revealed a world which was very much dominated by thinking about technology. And entrepreneurs, you know, when we were debating on the 2015 report, and I had invited someone who was dealing with the Institute of Future. I don't know if the person is here, but and good to see Marina there. And for them, the future is now, you know, driverless cars and apps to somehow empower people and send money to them. And for instance, there's a view, not just by Silicon Valley people, that we are technology has finally taken us to the point where microfinance is finally doable. Why? Because the cost of giving a loan is dramatically being reduced, because typically banks don't never were interested in small farmers or small firms because too much work for them, too much effort. And with this apps and technology, it's possible to reduce the cost dramatically and therefore bring those people into the financial world and financial markets. I think one big challenge for microfinance has been that it's never been part of capital markets. And I think gradually maybe this is the way to do that. I don't know if they are smart answers, but there's this series on television on Silicon Valley where everyone's saying, and I'm going to change the world. So maybe there's something real about this after all.
They are changing the world in a lot of ways, as you know.
I should say change the world for the better. I should have
added
that.
It's amazing. You walk down the streets of San Francisco, and somebody that looks like he cannot afford to buy breakfast is working on his iPhone.
Right. But
it's
not just
astounding.
That. I think what is amazing is this ICT revolution is a profound one, that farmers in Africa, through their cell phones, can know, communicate, but also know the price of their products, I mean, the what they're trying to sell, wheat, rice, get better prices for it, connect with each other. And remember, all the investments in landlines have disappeared. It's the mobile phones.
That's one of the magical things.
Amazing.
They never had to make in India or Pakistan.
Right.
They never had to make the investment in cable that is underground in New York here. It's an amazing device, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we can talk to people 200 or 2,000 miles away and there's no wires.
Yeah, you still need wireless, but that's a different, you still need to connect in some ways, yeah.
So what tangible impact have the Millennium Development Goals and the UN Development Reports had on most vulnerable, on the most vulnerable? How do you measure your specific gains, and what does success look like to the UN, to the major NGOs? That's a very good question.
I am a great fan of the MDGs, and I think this is a really extraordinary moment for the world and the United Nations in particular, and I think one has to thank the leadership of Kofi Annan and others that they brought the world together into a framework of doing collective stuff. And there's a lot of debate whether the MDGs led to this thing or that thing, but the fact is the goals were set. And
MDG,
we managed
meaning Millennium Goals.
Millennium Development Goals.
How long ago was that?
Big goal was started 2000, it's meant to finish 2015. And one big goal is to reduce poverty by half. And that has been met several years ahead of the 2015. Huh? And I think that's quite remarkable. That
reduce poverty per capita.
Reduce poverty by a certain threshold by half. So the number of poor people has gone down dramatically, globally. And actually, we exceeded that 50% target. So on health and education, there were various targets set up. So I think it certainly was an important political framework for bringing the world together. One can debate endlessly whether did it lead to actual poverty reduction or not. And I think this is why it's equally important that the next goals are goals which mean something, that they are about sustaining the world and about reducing vulnerability in the way we talked about.
This one goes back to the population question again. The questioner says, I am a neo-Malthusian, which assumes that means of production increases arithmetically, 1, 2, 3, 4, while population increases geometrically, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, the picture is not pretty. Technology and peace can help. Am I right or am I wrong?
Well, you know, Malthusian was proven to be wrong, just to let you, just for the sake of it, just to make that point. You know, actually, long-term forecasts. There was an event I went to, and some people had these long-term forecasts. You know, a century-long forecast. actually talk about a, you know, we are 7 billion people, we may peak at 9 billion, maybe a little bit more, but we then start coming down. Huh? And some people posit that we may come down to 2.5, 3 billion people. Now, of course, declining population is also a headache. You know, entire cities start disappearing. Huh? Entire production system have to be reorganized. So one has to manage this thing carefully. As Bill was talking about, that if you have a youth bulge, it's seen as a demographic dividend, meaning countries can grow because these people come to the labor market, they produce things, they consume things. So population is something one has to think in a more holistic way. You know, all the, in the, there was a very famous report which came out called The Limits to Growth. The Club of Rome became famous for that. And the argument was we're rapidly running out of most things, oil and water. And many of these things may be true, but human ingenuity is also quite profound. It somehow finds ways to find more oil and get more agriculture production. But some, we have to balance it, clearly. And as I said, birth rates are declining quite rapidly, actually, in the last few decades. And that's mostly because of education. There are entire societies which are not producing more children. And very rapid declines in Europe, in East Asia, in Korea, countries
like
that.
Yeah, it's very encouraging. My father started the Population Crisis Committee, now called Population Action International, when he was very concerned about, in the developing world particularly, he wasn't that interested in domestic, but he'd be very pleased today if he were around to see the evening off and the increase in education, as right. you say, that has driven down the population growth. Here's a good point. Poverty and disadvantage cannot, disadvantages cannot be fully beaten back until the massive amount of corruption in the developing world is addressed effectively. Sorry?
I'm just cheering the question.
Oh, I got it. So
I
there are
be
two,
careful how
two,
I respond
two people
to it.
That want the answer. Quite a few people want to answer that. And
venal bastards who are running the countries.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
I see. All right.
You must be a Republican.
Well, you know, I was at the last global conference in Rio, and I was very struck by a couple of things. One was there was a view that our leaders are not doing their job, so we all have to become leaders ourselves. And the eco-citizenship movement, which was started, that we all have to play a role in influencing future change. And ultimately, leaders have to do what people want. So if people are committed and they're empowered and they want to move things forward, leaders will follow. There's another contrasting view. And contrasting view is actually a friend, Juan Somavia, who was the head of ILO before, has now taken the view that we are living in a leaderless world, meaning that where are the leaders of today as opposed to before? Now, when you look at issues of corruption, and I think when people are more educated and motivated to hold officials and institutions accountable, that's when things start changing and changing for the better.
But do you think that some future human development report would have some kind of rating system? That there is, what is the organization that does put out a...
Yeah, the Transparency International.
Yeah.
Actually, Bill, you'll remember that I think in 1994 or 95, Mahbub had put in a certain amount of political freedom index attempt.
I think that's right.
And nearly destroyed the report and the organization. And you had to go protect it from Washington and all the governments who were after
Washington
us.
Washington would not.
No, because Washington was, U.S. was not doing so well.
All the developing countries
No, I know,
like
but the U.S. was not doing so well in that ranking. And I remember you had to go to Washington to
I never.
Lead the
never.
Anyhow.
That was never
We have long memories in these matters.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, do we want to get into Pakistan versus the U.S. on that subject?
I think Pakistan is in a state of profound chaos right now, and that's a sad comment.
That's one thing. When you become a part of the U.N., you feel like you're international and your country is... It can be criticized and
should
it's
be.
Seen and should be.
Be.
And there are so many times you see your own country in a different light.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Because you want to hold them accountable to a higher standard.
Yeah.
And I think that's the right thing to do also.
Yeah. Now, so here's a question. What place does design thinking have in developing solutions for poverty?
It's kind of similar question to the technology one, you know, finding the right app and somehow you'll reduce poverty. I think there's some basic things you have to do to reduce poverty. And that comes back to the same things we talked about, health, education.
Health and education, they really don't have... Education, very important, and healthy, very important.
Right.
But what about systems?
Well, I was going to say that when you look at historical evidence in Europe, why did poverty go down? It was, of course, economies were doing better. Discrimination was reduced. People were able to participate more. Institutions were better designed. So you need many things to come together to reduce poverty, increase the standards of most people. I think there's no single solution, meaning a better system design can somehow, on its own, result in reduced poverty.
Well, I would disagree with that. I would say that a good, strong government should encourage a good, strong private sector. You said it right, I think, where you need both. You need government regulation and you need a vibrant private sector to generate jobs. I mean, governments don't really create much in the way of jobs or wealth or poverty alleviation. It's really private sector that does that. In just about every successful country in the world, it relies on that. But there is there is disagreement. I mean, you may not even agree with what I've just said, but don't you think that more can be done in every country, including our own, to release the energy? Well, look at China. What a dramatic change. I met with Deng Xiaoping in 1981 about, and with Don Regan, who was then Secretary of Treasury, and I was running the Export-Import Bank of the U.S. And he said he had been in power only 2 years. And he said, when I took over, everybody had to make grow rice for the Iron Rice Bowl. And I found that everybody was poor he came from Sichuan, so in Sichuan. And so I said, you can grow anything you want. And you can be rich if you want to, and the story about the cat can be black or white, but as long as it catches rats. He was telling us at that point that he was changing the policies. He said, I'm going to do this in all 14 provinces. And that man changed more lives for the better than probably any other man in history, because there were so many of them in China, and you know China, so maybe you were there at the time. This was 1981? No. But I think that was such a major change from what Mao had there. And the entrepreneurship, the Chinese are just naturally entrepreneurial and energetic, and they freed them. And we talk about freedom in the Human Development Report. That is a freedom that should be encouraged in a big time way, maybe in your next report.
Well, we're also very disciplined in the UN. We never disagree with our bosses. So,
but he's no longer your boss.
But I think the point, if you take China, actually I have a book on China on these matters, and you know, if you do not educate people, you cannot grow. So without Mao, Deng Xiaoping would not have succeeded. You know, by the Second World War, life expectancy.
Wait, I missed the link there.
Okay, I'm going to explain the link. Oh. In the Second World War, life expectancy in China had gone down to 44, 45 years. By late 70s, when Deng Xiaoping started his market-oriented reform, it had gone up to 66. People were better educated. Huh? So when he opened up markets, it allowed many people to benefit from their prosperity. And what the other thing?
Wait a minute.
Yeah, so this is the.
Mao is a guy who was devastating to education.
No, that's not correct.
Oh.
Mao actually introduced a lot of reforms. He, you know, there's a Chinese saying that if you ask the Chinese how do they look at Mao, they say that Mao was 70% good and 30% bad. That's how the Chinese. They had this formula about Mao. So I think in terms of policies, the four modernizations which Mao and then Deng Xiaoping embraced were very important, actually. They created that base for the future. I think another thing what China, the state, did very well was to create markets when they did not exist. I'll give you a very practical example. Wine making in China. There was no tradition of wines in the tradition, I mean, the modern sense of wine making. So what they did was to, the local municipalities decided to buy wine, encourage some entrepreneurs to grow wine, and then they will buy it for a 10-year period. And through that process, created a market for wine. And now China is about to become one of the largest producers, by the way, of cheap wine, following the same principle.
I was going to ask, how much Chinese wine have you drunk?
Not so much.
Now we're running, we're actually at the end of the program. And we can go have some wine.
All right.
So maybe Chinese wine if it's around, but I prefer Napa Valley. Anyway, thank you so much, Khalid Malik. Let's give him a big hand for a lot of good work.